The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Dina Halick, and I am in love with Jamie Frazier. Yeah. Yeah. So I met him for the first time when my entire group of friends at university, boys and girls, read Outlander, and we all fell in love with it. And all these years later, Jamie still continues to be one of my top two literary crushes. Gilbert Blythe is the other one. So, thank you. So Diana Gabaldon invited us into the world of Claire and Jamie in 1991, and she's just released her eighth book in the saga, written in my own heart's blood. I could tell you all about her. You probably know more about her than I do. So I would also like to say, to make it even more exciting, the TV show of Outlander premieres August 9th. Yeah. And we are actually going to show you the trailer for the show. So as soon as they get it started, we will watch it.
People disappear all the time. Most are found eventually. Disappearances, after all, have explanations. Usually.
I try and remember my husband.
Not alive. You need not be scared so long as I'm with you.
And when you're not with me.
Be careful.
We have viewing parties already planned, my friends and I. But since you are not here to listen to me, you are here to listen to Diana Gabaldon. Without further ado, may I present to you, and welcome her to the stage, please, Diana Gabaldon.
Well, thank you very much. I didn't know the trailer was that exciting. Can you all hear me to start with? Yes, great. If you can't, at some point, start going like this. And I will lean forward some more. But so far, so good. Yeah, this actually reminds me quite a lot of when I used to live in Philadelphia back in the 1970s. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Horrible place. I hated it. It's improved a lot since, though. Today was much nicer. I could step outside of my hotel without feeling personally threatened. Yeah. My husband got an MBA at Wharton, and I did a postdoc appointment at UPenn. And we lived in grad student housing in UPenn over on Chestnut Street. People were regularly shot outside our building. So It's got better, yeah, so this is nice. But anyway, nice to be here. While I was here, I used to teach human anatomy and physiology at the Community College of Philadelphia downtown. Yeah, which didn't make me feel any safer, but it... It did equip me for a later job at the Arizona State University, where I also taught human anatomy and physiology. And there I taught at two auditoriums like this. They were full of 400 or 500 people. It was a popular science elective. Everybody took it, including the football team, because they thought it would be easy. And I'd walk in at 8 every morning, and there they would all be in the front row, sound asleep. And so... large inanimate blobs of flesh. I'd walk up to the edge of the podium and say, well, this morning, gentlemen, we're going to discuss the history of contraception. And they'd all start blinking. And say, in days of old, when knights were bold and condoms not invented, they wrapped old socks around their cocks and babies were prevented. Well, it worked on the football players, too. Now, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, well, how did you get from being a scientist to being a novelist? And I said, well, easy, I wrote a book. And that's all you have to do. They don't make you get a license or anything. In fact, when I tell people that in Germany, they're just shocked. They're saying, how did you dare to do that? They say, nobody in Germany would dare write a novel without getting a PhD in literature first. And... which I said, well, maybe that's why 80% of your catalog is American authors. Because it is, really. I knew from a very early age that I was supposed to be a novelist. I was about 8, I think, when I realized that people actually wrote books. They didn't just pop out of the library shelves like toilet paper in the grocery store. And I knew that's what I was supposed to do, but I didn't know how. Anybody who writes novels kind of rolls their own. I have a good friend named Ian Rankin, who is a fairly well-known Scottish crime writer. Yeah, yeah, no, great guy. And the bio in the back of his book for years gave a brief precis of his earlier careers, which included tax collector and swineherd. One evening, I was introducing him at our local bookstore where he was doing an event, and I said, well, I've always wondered, Ian, can you tell me how it is you came to be a swineherd? He said, well, yes. He said, when I was much younger, my wife and I had jobs on a French vineyard because she spoke French, and, you know, I slopped the hogs, so I didn't have to speak French. But... He said, I took care of the outside stuff, and she was sort of the domestic. He said it was a small vineyard and very traditional, so when the grapes were harvested, everybody, you know, stripped off and stomped the grapes naked and kind of had a debauch over the weekend. And he said, so this was all great. He said, I woke up, you know, very late after this debauch, realized that the pigs hadn't been fed, and so I just went and threw the mass, the grape skins and pulp into the pigs' troughs, said, and they all died of alcohol poisoning. So that was the end of his career as a swineherd. Fortunately, nothing that drastic has ever happened to me, but I have had some fairly picturesque jobs in my time, including the one which was here at UPenn where I butchered seabirds for a living. That was fairly gross. And then there was the one where I tortured boxfish. That was at UCLA. Well, it wasn't really torture. I was just putting them in a water tunnel and making them swim fast so I could take high-speed motion pictures of them. So it had a little fan, you know, that made the water move faster back then. And a boxfish, it's a very descriptive name. They have very rigid skeletons. They're built like little boxes. You've probably seen them. Their tail goes like that, back and forth, and their fins go like this. And their bodies don't wiggle like salmoniform swimmers or whatever. It's called ostracoform motion. Don't worry about it. Anyway, my job was to put these boxfish one at a time into a water tunnel and seal it and turn on the oxygen calibration. We wanted to see how much oxygen they used as they were swimming and, you know, did they alter their swimming? Because in most animals, if you make them move faster, they use more oxygen. So you put anything in an oxygen chamber and make it run, it uses more oxygen, and the oxygen curve goes like that. box fish, it doesn't work that way. It goes up to a certain point and then it flattens out. They swim faster and faster, but they don't use any more oxygen. So we wondered why. And that was my job, was to take motion pictures and see if they were, you know, maybe doing something different with their fins when they hit that point. Yeah, because actually running is more energetically efficient than walking fast. So, you know, you can walk fast up to a point, but then when you're forced to break into a run, your oxygen consumption actually drops a little bit. We thought maybe they were doing something like that. So anyway, I would drop a fish in, screw down the top, turn on my camera and the fan, and they start going like this. And I turn it up and they'd be going like this. And finally they'd kind of go, and follow her backwards, and then I turn it off, you know, and take them out and take them back to their tank to recover. So, yeah. Yeah, well, it's better than being a swineherd, let's put it that way. Anyway, I didn't know how to start writing a novel, and I did realize that it was kind of financially iffy. I grew up in a very conservative family background. My father was fond of saying to me, "Well, you're such a poor judge of character, you're bound to marry some bum," he'd say. "So be sure you get a good education so you can support your children." So with this going on at home, I thought I wouldn't announce that I wanted to write novels. And then instead, I went into science. You know, I liked science. I was good at it. I enjoyed research, and I liked teaching a lot. But I still wanted to write novels. And when I turned 35, I said to myself, "Well, you know, Mozart was dead at 36. Maybe you better get started here." And so I said, okay, my next birthday, I'm going to start writing a novel. Because up to this point, I had written all kinds of things, and no one had ever shown me how to write any of it, from a doctoral dissertation that was a 400-page opus entitled "Nest Site Selection in the Pinion Jay, Gymnorhinus cyanocephalus." Or, as my husband said, "Why birds build nests where they do, and who cares anyway?" Yes, all the way through scholarly journal articles and, you know, grant proposals and computer documentation and tutorials and textbooks and even Walt Disney comic books. And no one had ever shown me how to write any of this stuff. I just read some, and then I wrote one, and if it didn't look right, I poked it till it did. I said, "Okay, you've been reading novels for 30-odd years. Surely if you write one, you will recognize it." Okay. I said, "All right, I'm going to write a novel. I'm starting on my next birthday. Now, this is just for practice. I'm not going to show it to anyone. I'm not going to tell anyone what I'm doing, especially not my husband. He would have tried to stop me. Not out of any fear that I would that I would write a novel that he didn't like, but out of fear that I would drop dead. Because while I did not marry a bum, I married a very nice man, whom I still have 42 years later. Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm 62, if any of you are trying to figure that one out. But he did quit work 3 months after our first child was born in order to start his own business. And I do have to say that in terms of financial stability, there's not that much to choose between an entrepreneur and a bum. So for our first few years in his business, I was our sole support, and we kept having children. So I had to find some means of earning money other than prostitution in the home. And I said, "What do I know how to do?" Well, I had sort of slid sideways from my original specialty and become a, quote, expert in scientific computation. It's really easy to be an expert if there's only 6 people in the world who do what you do. And that was my position at the time. This was the early 1980s, and microcomputers, as they were then called, were just barely beginning to creep into academia. So I started a scholarly journal called Science Software Quarterly, which told scientists how to do things like laboratory automation and data analysis. And, you know, within a year, I was an expert. As I say, I was teaching international seminars on, you know, data acquisition and analysis and so on. So in the need during extra money came around, what I did was send a brief query letter to the editors of Byte and InfoWorld and all the other PC magazines of the time. It was a very short letter, and it included a copy of my Science Software Quarterly, with self as editor-in-chief, and a copy of a comic book that I had done for Walt Disney's Educational Media Division, entitled Nutrition Adventures with Orange Bird. It was a real short letter. It said, "Dear Sirs," they were all men, and saying, "As you can see from the enclosed, you won't find anyone who knows more about scientific and technical software than I do, and at the same time can write so as to appeal to a broad popular audience." So this got immediate results, and within a year I was making as much freelancing for the computer press as I was at the university, which just goes to show how badly they pay the assistant faculty. But anyway, so at the time I decided it was the ideal time to start writing a novel. I had 2 full-time jobs and 3 children under the age of 6. Yeah. So for any of you who are aspiring writers, I don't want to hear that you don't have time. You make time or you don't have any. That's how it works. So anyway, I didn't tell anyone what I was doing. I just said, okay, what I want to know is what does it take to write a novel? Because I've never written a novel before. And, you know, it's kind of a big project and it's fiction. I've never done this before. So I need to know what does it take in terms of mental commitment and daily discipline and organization and research and so forth. So only 2 rules here. I will write the entire book, no matter how bad I may think it is as I go along, because I need to know what the whole process is like. I'm going to have to slow down or her fingers are going to fall off. Sorry, I didn't see you down there before. Yes, thank you. Yes, I mean, I'm kind of used to talking at a high rate of speed, but we'll slow it down as much as possible. That was my first rule, is I will write the whole thing. The second rule was I will do the absolute best I can with the writing every single day. Because if I'm not doing my best, how will I know if I'm any good? And how will I get any better? So those were my only 2 rules. So the next question, of course, was what kind of book am I going to write? Because, I read everything and lots of it. And I was thinking, well, you know, I read a lot of mysteries. Maybe I should write a mystery. And I said, no, mysteries have plots. I'm not sure I can do that. And so I said, what's the easiest kind of book I could write for practice? And so after a bit of thought, I decided perhaps historical fiction. I was a research professor. I knew my way around a library. I said it seems easier to look things up than to make them up. And if I turn out to have no imagination, I can steal things from the historical record. Which actually works really well. And so I said, fine, historical novel. Where shall I set this? I've got no background in history, just the 6 hours of Western civilization they make you take as an undergraduate. She's spelling Western civilization. And not to make you self-conscious or anything. It was fascinating to watch from behind. Yeah. Usually I can't see the interpreter, they're behind me. Anyway, so I said, you know, historical novel, where shall I set this? So I was looking for a congenial time and place, you know, American Civil War, Italian Renaissance. I'd have to look it all up anyway. So in this malleable frame of mind, I happened to see a really old Doctor Who rerun on public television. Yes, I'm glad Doctor Who is getting more popular, so I don't have to stop and explain who he is every time. For the benefit of those who are not giggling or waving, Doctor Who is a really old, really long-running show that's done in the UK, where it was originally a fantasy show for children. Now it's gotten much more adult, but it's still running after 60 years. And the Doctor of the title is a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey, who travels through space and time having adventures. And along the way, he picks up companions from different periods of Earth's history. So in this really old episode, the Doctor, it was one of the Patrick Troughton episodes, he had picked up a young Scotsman from 1745. And this was a young man who appeared in his kilt, you know, 18, 19-year-old young man. And I said, well, that's kind of fetching. And I found myself still thinking about this the next day in church. And I said, And I said, well, you know, you want to write a book. It doesn't really matter where you set this. Why not? You know, Scotland, 18th century. So that's where I began, knowing nothing about Scotland or the 18th century, having no plot, no characters, and no outline, nothing but the rather vague images conjured up by the notion of a man in a kilt. Which is, of course, a very powerful and compelling image. In fact, Breath of Snow and Ashes was a very lucky book for me. It opened at 1 on the bestseller lists of 4 countries, which is cool. Oh, thanks. Thank you very much. Yeah. And it also won me a couple of prizes. It won me the Quill Award for, and I quote, science fiction, fantasy, and horror. What was neat about that one was that I beat out George R.R. Martin and Stephen King. Yeah, Stephen King's book is number one on the New York Times list this week. We'll see about next week. Yes, well, I know you all did your part. No, and that book also won me the Corina International Prize for Fiction, which is very cool. And I got to go to Germany to accept the award. Well, while I was there, the German publisher had me interviewed by everyone in the German press, from the tabloid newspapers up to their equivalent of Vanity Fair. And toward the end of this week, I was interviewed every half hour all day for days on end. I was sort of going like this. But I was being talked to by a nice gentleman from a literary magazine. And he said, oh, I've read all your books. They're wonderful. He said, your narrative drive is tremendous. And your characters, they're so three-dimensional. And your imagery is just magical. And I'm thinking, yes, yes, go on. And, instead, he stopped and he said, there's just this one thing I wonder. Could you tell me what is the appeal of a man in a kilt? Well, you know, he was a German. And there's a saying, you know, every man looks good in a kilt, no man looks good in lederhosen. But anyway, I was really tired, or I might not have said it, but I just looked at him for a minute, and I said, well, I suppose it's the idea that you could be up against a wall with him in a minute. Well, you know, 3 weeks later, I'm home, and I get a packet of press clippings from this little junket. With that interview on top, I recognized his name. I can read German, but very slowly. But the publisher had put a post-it note in English on top. She said, I don't know what you told this man, but I think he is in love with you. So anyway, as I say, very powerful and compelling image. So that's essentially where I began, was with a man in a kilt. And I went, of course, to the library to begin doing my research. And the only thing I knew about novels at this point was that they should have conflict. That's still the best thing I know about novels, as you will have noticed if you've been reading this book. But I was looking in the 18th century, and you don't look in Scotland in the 18th century for conflict without finding Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Jacobite Rebellion. And I said, well, that looks like conflict, all right, good, we'll use that. And I said, now I must have a lot of Scotsmen, of course, because of the kilt factor, but I think it would be a good idea if I had a woman to play off these guys, then we'll have, you know, female character, sexual tension, conflict, that's good. I said, now essentially, from my 3 days' research, it looks like the English versus the Scots, so if I make her an English woman, we will have lots of conflict. So on the third day of writing, I introduced this English woman. No idea who she was, what she was doing there, how she got into the plot, but I loosed her into a cottage full of Scotsmen to see what she'd do. And they were all crouched around the hearth, muttering to themselves. They turned around, saw her, and stared at her. And I was thinking, why? Does she look funny? What's going on here? Well, one of them drew himself up, and he said, my name's Dougal Mackenzie, and who might you be? And without my stopping to think, I just typed, my name's Claire Elizabeth Beecham, and who the hell are you? I said, well, you don't sound at all like an 18th century person. So I fought with her for several pages, trying to beat her into shape and make her talk like a historical person. She wasn't having any. She just kept making smart-ass modern remarks. And she also took over and started telling the story herself. So I said, well, I'm not going to fight with you all the way through this book. No one's ever going to see this. It doesn't matter what bizarre thing I do. I said, go ahead and be modern. I'll figure out how you got there later. So it's all her fault that there's time travel in these books. Well, various things happened, and I got an agent before I finished writing the book, in fact. And so when I did finish it, I sent him well, my query letter to him was fairly simple and straightforward. I said, "Dear Mr. Knowlton, I've been writing and selling nonfiction by myself for several years, but now that I am writing a novel, I understand I need good literary representation. You've been recommended to me by, you know, these various friends I knew who were writers and who had, in fact, recommended me to him. I said, I have a very long historical novel. I don't want to waste your time. Would you be willing to read excerpts from it?" I didn't tell him it wasn't finished. Excerpts were all I had. But he very kindly said yes, he'd read my excerpts. So I hastily wrote a 26-page single-spaced synopsis. And what did they say? It's supposed to be a page and a half. Yeah, anyway, I wasn't kidding. It is a very long novel. Anyway, I sent it to him along with my excerpts, and he took me on the basis of a first novel, unfinished, which is not usual now, and it wasn't usual then either, but very lucky. Well, 6 months later, I finally finished it, and I sent it to him, called to tell him it was coming. And I said, "You know, I realized as I'm finishing this book that there's more to the story, but I thought I should stop while I could still lift it. But if anybody's interested, you can tell them there's more." So I also told him I would be in New York the next week for a scientific conference. And he said, as I'd hoped, "Well, come up and meet me, you know, I'd come to my office," because we'd never met face to face. So I did, and went up in some trepidation of mind, because at this point, Perry Knowlton was the only person in the world who had read the whole manuscript, and I didn't yet know what he thought about it. So he turned out to be a charming older gentleman who took me back to his office, got me a Diet Coke, everyone gets me Diet Coke, and started chatting with me to put me at my ease. His conversation was not as reassuring as he probably thought, because at this point I realized that in addition to my friends, he also represented Tony Hillerman, Frederick Forsyth, and Robertson Davies. And the estate of Ayn Rand. And I was sitting there thinking, if you have the nerve to call Robertson Davies Robbie, which he was doing, you are a better man than I am. But what was most unnerving was that he had my manuscript sitting on the desk in front of him in the huge orange box in which I'd shipped it. And at one point, I was sure that he was going to give it back to me and say, "Well, now that I've read the whole thing, it's just too weird. There's nothing I can do with it." I was expecting to hear this, but instead he said, "Well, you know, the thing about Freddie Forsyth and Robbie Davies and those guys is that they're all great storytellers." And he laid a hand on the box and smiled at me and said, "And you're another one." Thank you. Well, at this point, of course, I was so gratified I didn't care what he did with it, but I gathered enough wits to ask, and he said, "Well, I'm sending it out today to 5 editors who I think might like it," and he explained to me what they all were like, and I said, "That's great. You know, how long do you think we might have to wait for an answer?" Because I'd been reading Writer's Market, and it says, you know, 18 months, 2 years, which is fine by me, and he said, "Oh, I've told them all I want an answer in 30 days. I'm thinking, boy, you picked the right agent. So I... went home to wait for 30 days. Well, 4 days later, I got a call on my answering machine. It said, "This is Perry. I've just called to update you about your manuscript. Call me back." So I did, and he said, "Of the 5 editors that I've sent it to so far, 3 of them have called back with offers to buy it," which was great. So he negotiated amongst them for 2 weeks, and he told them all, "She says there's more." And they said, "Trilogies are very popular. Do you think she could write 3? Being a good agent, he said, "Oh, I'm sure she could." And, so they gave me a 3-book contract, and, you know, bing, I was a novelist. Yes, thank you. Everybody okay there? Okay. Just have to keep an eye here. And so anyway, I would just like to point out that I never said it was a trilogy. I just said there's more. And we may as well start off our questioning by my answering the no doubt burning question in many of your minds. Yes, there is more. There is a 9th book. Thank you. Well, I'm glad you all feel that way about it. Yeah, actually, I should say there will be a 9th book when I have time to actually begin writing it, which is not quite yet. But at this point, we will switch over to questions. And so if any of you have any burning questions, I see we have a couple of nice minions here with microphones who will be happy to run to wherever you are. So if you would like to, there's a lady not too far off on your right.
My big question is, how long into this process did you wait before you let your husband know what you were up to?
Yes, when did my husband find out? Well, I'd been at it for about 6 months, I think, and his business had gotten to the point where he could move out of our converted garage and get office premises, but he still would come into the garage, which I had inherited, and print out contracts and things in the evening. So one evening he came in, and, you know, when I had a novel scene up on one screen, I would just switch to a grant proposal when he came in. But anyway, he came in and said, oh, I have to print out the so-and-so contract. Do you mind if I use the computer for a minute? I said, no, go right ahead. Well, this was back in the days when it was an IBM XT was what we had, the newest and greatest. And if any of you are old enough to have actually used DOS, you'll remember that there was one key you pressed that brought up the directory of all the files on the computer. So he couldn't remember what he'd called the contract, and he pressed that key. Well, I call all my work files Jamie. And so he looked at these 50 or 60 files called Jamie. He looked at me and he said, who's Jamie? He said, it's this book I'm writing, all right. So anyway, that's where he found out. Yes, anyone on that side?
How much of Claire is you? Because I feel like that when I read the books.
Yes, how much of Claire is me? 15.3%. I get that kind of question quite a bit. I would just remind you of the local fans who take me out to tea once in a while, and on one of these occasions got started on the character of Black Jack Randall. And they're all going, oh, he's so loathsome, he's such scum, he makes my skin crawl. And I'm sitting there sipping my tea and thinking, you have no idea you're talking to Black Jack Randall, do you? Yeah, now and again talk to Tobias Menzies, who's playing that character. It's fairly interesting conversations, I'll tell you. Yes, anybody on this side, maybe middle of the aisle there.
Scotland's going to make a vote for independence.
Yes.
In the ninth novel, are you going to bring your characters to present day and involve current events?
Oh, let's see. Am I going to bring the characters to the present day and current events and rope in the Scottish independence movement? It actually might make a difference as to what that vote is. Yeah, I haven't actually started work on the ninth novel. I have little bits and pieces, but I won't get my regular routine back until September at the earliest. So, I'm not looking too far ahead. But it is an interesting question. People ask me, what do you think of it? And I say, well, I have opinions, of course. And being an American, and a romantic at heart, of course, I'm in favor of independence and democracy. On the other hand, I can certainly see the arguments against. But what I say in public is, it's not my country. I sort of don't have a right to express an opinion in public, so stay out of it. Yeah, anybody on that side there?
Do you think that there's any medical procedure that Claire would not want to do?
Do I think there's any medical procedure that Claire would not want to do? Yeah, there's probably any number of them. But in fact, you'll run into one later in the book. Yeah. Let's see. On this side, there's somebody here in the middle.
I'm Denise, asking for the ladies of Lallybrook. Somebody asked me to ask you, what's in Brianna's big shoulder bag? If you can answer any kind of a Moby question, I don't know if it's appropriate. Or not.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I don't actually know. Okay, anybody on that side? There's someone over by the wall.
Who are your favorite authors?
Who are my favorite authors? Boy, well, I'm 62, and I learned to read at the age of 3 and never stopped, so I have literally dozens of favorite authors, starting with the Trixie Belden books and working on them. But strong Trixie Belden contingent here. On my website, if you go there, click on resources, and then on something called the methadone list. And this is my answer to people who say, what am I supposed to read while I'm waiting for your next book? But it's a list of, you know, about 20 really good authors that I like a lot from a wide range of genres. There's just everything in there, so there's bound to be something that you would like. Though most recently, the two best books that I've read were one by Phil Rickman. I love his entire series. He's a Welsh author and has this interesting series. It's sort of ostensibly crime, but with a supernatural element running through it, and it's on the Welsh border and very evocative, and the landscape is part of it. But when people say, you know, can you tell me anybody who writes like you do, he's the closest I could come. Yeah. His main character is a Anglican vicar named Merrily Watkins, who is a widow with an obnoxious teenage daughter. She's also the official exorcist for the Diocese of Hereford. They're very, very good. Yeah, and over here.
Hi, my name is Alan. Are you aware and ever surprised of how far all of your fans go with, like, paraphernalia, shirts, things? like, you don't ever have to sell a thing, although you can make a fortune on all the things that we do. Are you ever surprised about that?
Am I surprised about the lengths to which fans will go in terms of T-shirts and things like that? Yes, actually, I am. It's been a slowly evolving phenomenon ever since the Ladies of Lallybroch are the oldest and first online fan group. But I think that is just an unexpected but very charming side effect of the books, is the way in which people form instant friendships around them. You know, people standing in lines, even very long lines, they're never annoyed by the time they get to me because they've been having such a good time with everybody else there. So it's really a very nice phenomenon. Yeah, and on that side, do you have anybody?
Hello, my name is Sherry, and mm-hmm. I've enjoyed the novellas and all of the offshoot books, Lord John Grey and all that.
Thank you.
But I would wonder if you would ever consider writing a book about Brian and Ellen's love story.
Would I consider writing a book about Jamie's parents, Brian and Ellen? Oh, I would not only consider it, I have actually started writing that one.
Diana, I'm a nurse, mm-hmm. and my question to you and to the audience here is, I know those books have been passed around my hospital more than some of the viruses that we encounter, and my poll to you is how many of you are in the healthcare prep? Yeah, seriously, and just, it's a very popular book.
Yes, well, I appreciate that very much. Thank you. Yeah, I was going to say Outlander actually got a badge from the Nurses Association as their favorite book of the year or something. Yeah, and someone on that side?
Actually, as a follow-up to that, I was going to ask you, what made you make Claire a nurse? Because that's what drew me right away to the book, that she was a nurse in the Second World War.
Yeah. How did I come to make Claire a nurse? Well, as I say, I realized she was a time traveler pretty much right away. So the next question was, well, where did she come from? Or when did she come from, rather? And so I was thinking, well, if I were a time traveler, what sort of skills would I want? And I was thinking, I think I'd like to be something in the medical profession so I could keep people alive, including myself. And so I was thinking, well, should she be a doctor? And I was thinking, well, I don't want her to be a modern doctor because even in the 1980s, when I began writing this book, I began writing it in 1988, medicine was already very technological, and, you know, obviously revolutions were being made every day. And I was thinking, well, things are changing so fast. If I make her a doctor with medical knowledge as of today, the book will be dated, you know, within 5 years, and I don't want that to happen. So the other thing is that it is very technological. I didn't want her to be, you know, dropping to her knees next to a wounded man on a battlefield and going, oh, my God, if only I could put him through an MRI. You know, it's a yeah. Cognitive dissonance, you know. I wanted her to be the sort of person who would fall to her knees, you know, and immediately, you know, put her thumb on the spurting artery, you know, and start putting him back together. So I said, obviously, this is a person, you know, who's not from the 80s and 90s. She's from some time earlier. At the same time, I wanted her to have, in common with the reader, an appreciation of what modern medicine's assumptions are. Well, modern medicine rests on three major developments: antibiotics, antisepsis, and anesthesia. Okay, and so I wanted her to have those. All three of those came into common use during World War II. They were all invented earlier than that, but it was the war that brought them into common use and into the general population. And so having thought that, I thought, yes, she was a combat nurse in World War II. Thanks. Over here.
A question to the audience. How many here are librarians? Yes?
Few of those.
Your book is one of the most book talkable books. All you have to say is, well, do you like time travel? And then you immediately go to the G's. But my question is, where the heck did Claire get the phrase Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ?
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ is just something I came across in researching World War II. You know, it just popped up. Somebody was using it. I don't recall where exactly. But, you know, the minute I saw it, it sounded like something she would say. Yeah, anyone on that side? There's someone here.
We all know that you have a bit part in The Outlander, so can you tell us about that experience?
Oh, well, I can tell you a bit about it. She's talking about the cameo part that I have in the TV show, so they very kindly invited me to do that, and it was fun. You know, I got to be a TV actor for two entire days. It's sort of not as hard as you might think, and at the same time, it's much more physically demanding than you might think. In this particular one, I can't tell you who I am because they don't want me to. They want people to. You have to look for me. But it was a crowd shot, you know, a really big crowd. And the director, in honor of my appearance, I do get a speaking part. But in honor of my appearance, the director had designed this very ambitious 360-degree shot that went, you know, around the whole thing, up into a gallery, down and back in time to watch someone coming in for the door. So. To have a shot like that succeed, it means that every single one of 200 people has to do the right thing at the right time, and, including me. Now, luckily, I didn't flub anything up, so it was never my fault. But, you know, by the time you've done 20 takes of the same thing, you have lost any sense of, you know, hesitation or shyness. You know, it's just, you know, even when everything goes right, they want you to do it again because they want what they call coverage. In other words, they're going to use different shots from different cameras, and they want to make sure they have enough footage to choose from and have good shots of everything. And so, you know, we'd do what looked like a perfect take, and the assistant director would shout, cut, do it again, and we just do it again. So I was standing in a gallery in the Great Hall with everything blazing, you know, hearth fires, torches, candles, and also television lights from the ceiling beating down. And I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and you know, I'm a good judge of temperature. And we were all wearing, you know, woolen costumes because it's the Scottish Highlands and so forth. So I was standing there with all these extras, and I said, you know, it's 103 up here, you know, minimum, at which point the lady behind me fainted. You know, you know, Katrina, who's playing Claire, had given me her fan earlier, and I had it in my sleeves. I whipped it out whenever I was fanning this poor woman. At that point, they carried her out and said, well, you know, everybody come down. We're going to air the place out a little bit. Anyway, they took the temperature, and it was 103. So, you know, it's just kind of grueling. We were up there for 5 hours at least doing this one shot, you know, and the next day it was a different shot, but you know, a different place. But still, it was really interesting. I said to Sam Hewen afterward, he was saying, well, how'd you like it? And I said, well, I now have a new appreciation for what you do. I said, it's indentured servitude. I said, it's, you know, good indentured servitude, but still. I said, you know, they know where you are every single moment. And he said, well, yeah, they do. They know if you're in the restroom and how long you take. And I'll come get you if you take too long. And so forth. No, really. I mean, you are sort of handed from person to person to person by all these minions who, you know, are handling you with the greatest respect and so forth and asking you what you want for breakfast and so forth. And they bring you your breakfast. But they know where you are every single minute, and they will take you where you're supposed to be, you know, on the dot of when you're supposed to be there. So, you know, you never get to just sort of step aside and say, you know, well, I'm just taking a break here. You don't. You know, if they happen to leave you someplace for a few minutes, then you can, you know, chat with your friends or whatever. But other than that, you be where you're supposed to be all of the time. So, yeah, it's kind of intimidating because, the regular actors are working 12-hour days most days. They're working from, well, you have to be on set at about 5:30 in the morning in order to be made up and have your wig if you're wearing one, and then costume will fit you and so forth. It takes a lot of time, so it may take an hour to 2 hours to get everybody actually just ready to start work, and then they do the takes over and over. And if you go on a location shot, then you have to travel there. And so forth. So yeah, it's very physically demanding, and these poor people have hardly any time to have a personal life at all. You know, they might get one day off a week. Yeah, so I don't envy them, but they do a really good job. Yeah, now over on the side. Mm-hmm.
Hi, I wanted to ask you about Claire's medicinal herb book, or the book that she wrote about mm-hmm. for the housewives. Do you plan on putting that out, making that?
I might, yeah, in the fullness of time, you know, when I was fine. Yeah, it was about Claire's medicinal book. Would I ever actually write that? I might. But in the meantime, I have been writing over the last couple of years the second volume of The Outlandish Companion. So, thank you. I do actually work two or three projects at a time. It's not that it takes me 5 years to write a book. It's that it takes me 5 years to finish one of the big books. But I will point out that between Echo and the Bone and Moby, I have also published a graphic novel, a full-scale novel, Scottish Prisoner, and, you know, about eight different novellas. So, you know, and I have been writing Outlandish Companion, too, as well. So, you know, I am not idle. I may be slow, but I'm not idle. Anyway, Outlandish Companion 2 is about 80% finished, and now that Moby is off the decks, you know, I'll kind of turn a wider percentage of my time on that. So with luck, you'll get it in the spring, I think. Thank you. Yeah. We have time for, we have time for a few more. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have such an amazing, eclectic group of characters. Aside from the obvious, who is your favorite character?
Oh, my goodness. Who's my favorite character? Well, it varies, you know, depending on what I've been writing and you know, how it came out and so forth. At the moment, I'm really fond of William. But just because, you know, he seems to be, you know, he's, now that he's got a grip on himself, he's sort of shaping up. Yeah. But, and, you know, I've always been very fond of Black Jack Randall, but I can't work with him anymore without writing novellas. So, yeah, but of the ongoing characters at the moment, I'm really fond of William, but also of Germaine. And Jimmy, I think those two might get along well. Yeah, and over here, where's our microphone?
Hello, my name is Patricia Clancy, and I just wanted to thank you for your body of work, which, as everyone here knows, is truly amazing. And
thank you.
I have passed on my love of that to my daughter, Colleen, who's sitting in the center section over there, because we were tardy. But the question that I have for you is, how concerned are you about how the TV show will play out in doing justice to your work?
Oh, how concerned am I about how the TV show will do justice to my work? I think it'll do fine. I am a, quote, consultant on the show, which basically means that they pay me a certain amount of money to do this, and they, which is pretty cool. And they, you know, they send me scripts, and they let me see footage from the show and so forth, which is very nice of them. And they are kind enough to ask my opinion. They're not under any legal compulsion to take it. But and so I'm, you know, fairly modest about offering my opinions. But, you know, if I see something that's just really askew, I will mention it to them. And more often than not, they will do something to address whatever my concern was. But by and large, it's a really good, faithful adaptation. You know, it does have to be an adaptation. And Ron Moore and his partner Merrill came to my house after they signed the contract and spent 2 days with me talking over characters and storylines and backstories and was there anything I had left out that might be useful to them and so on. And we're sharing their ideas about adaptation. And Ron said, for instance, said, now the book begins slowly, which is not a problem in a book because the prose will draw people in. He said, but for a show, you've got to do something, you know, fairly spectacular, riveting, you know, right off, and to cement people's attention, and then you can back off a little bit. He said, now this is all about Claire. She's the central character. It's you know, we have to appreciate her for who she is almost immediately. He said, so what I'd like to do is a little two-minute visual prologue where we show Claire during World War II in a French military hospital, you know, putting people back together, blood spurting, you know, being who she is. And I'm going, yeah, sounds like a great idea. So, you know, we were pretty much on the same wavelength. So I like his adaptation very much. Anybody who's been reading the books will recognize the book in the show. You know, about 85% of it is straight out of the books. What isn't is little bits that, as Ron said, they're not stuff that wasn't in the books. There's stuff that could have been in the books or that was obviously in the books but off stage. So there's not a sense of jarring dislocation. But what those little bits that are useful for adaptation do is they give the whole thing this really interesting sense of novelty and discovery, and that while you know the story, you're watching to see what happens next because it might not be exactly what you're expecting. Since it is episodic, you know, they have to make each episode be a little story arc in itself, and so sometimes the scenes will be moved from where they were in the original chronology of the book. It's the same scene, same dialogue, but you know, they moved it slightly, and so they'll make sort of a little plot loop to get back to where you should be after that. And that little plot loop is not in any way jarring, but it's new, you know, and so it's fascinating to see how they do that. Yeah, there's over on that side.
Hi, my name's Nona. Kind of in the similar vein, I've just always really wondered, how do you tie all these things back together? So you say this all kind of came up out of nowhere, so you clearly weren't planning the stuff from the beginning, but you, book five, you'll pull back from book one, et cetera. You just bring it all in a circle over and over and over, and I'm just wondering, how can you do that?
I'm not actually sure there's an answer to that. it's very organic, I can tell you that much, but I will tell you that foreshadowing works even better if you look back over your shoulder instead of writing it straight ahead. I mean, often I will be working in a book and I'll think, you know, I need to do this. I'm wondering how I can do that. I will look back over my shoulder and see that, well, there's a character back there, you know, who I just sort of left, you know, and why don't I just bring him up here? He can do that. I think in shapes is what it comes down to. Now, I see a lot of people leaving to go stand in line. Don't feel you have to do this. I should tell you that I spent an hour before the events this afternoon pre-signing books, so there is a big pile of books that already have a signature, if any of you don't want to stand in a line of 600 other people, and what you want is just a signed book, you don't care if it's personalized or not, then you can just take one and go. You know, you don't need to stand in line, so bear that one in mind. I'm happy to personalize your books if you'd like that, though, so totally, it's totally up to you. You just should know that that's available to you. Okay, what do we have? We got about five more minutes. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't remember which side we were on, so we'll go there.
After you did your initial couple of days of research and you found your characters, you said you didn't know anything about plot or storytelling.
Right.
So how did that happen? How did you come up with the story? Did it come out of your historical research or unfold in your head? Or
stories always come out of the character. Who is this person, and what is their circumstance? And that's what a story is. It's a character in a situation of conflict. And the story is, what does this person want? And what will they do to get it? And what happens to them? Do they get what they want? Do they not get what they want? Do they get something different? You know, what happens? That's where the story evolves. But it all comes down to the character and who these people are. So I just lived with these characters and thought about them. And you know, you have Claire. The first thing I knew about her was that she was a time traveler. What does a time traveler want? They want to get back where they came from. So immediately I knew what her conflict was and her motivation. So a lot of stuff followed from there. What's stopping her? Well, all of these men and kills to start with. And, you know, it just kind of goes on. Yes, over there.
How many actors read for the part of Jamie before Sam was picked?
How many characters read for the part of Jamie before Sam Heughan got it? Almost none. He was the first person cast, and he was pretty much the first person who read for it as well. Ron and Merrill called to tell me they were so excited they'd found Jamie. I was saying, what, really? You just barely started casting, because everyone thought it would just be really difficult to find a guy to play Jamie. And they said, we're so excited, we're sending you his audition tape. And I said, great. But I was on the road at the time with my husband. We were driving to Santa Fe, and I said, you know, I can't look at it till tonight when I get there, but we're looking forward to it. So they spelled his name for me. And so I was Googling him on my iPhone as we were driving, and I was going, this guy looks grotesque. What are you thinking? Sam's a very chameleonic actor. He looks totally different in every single one of his parts, and the pictures that he put, I don't know who put up his IMDb photos, but they're not doing him any favors. Anyway, so I was a little squiggle-eyed when I got to my computer, but I booted it up, and I'm sort of looking through my fingers, you know, not sure what I'm going to see. Anyway, came on, and 5 seconds in, I'm thinking, well, he looks fine, you know, he doesn't look like his pictures at all. 5 seconds later, he's gone, and it's just Jamie Fraser right there. I was just absolutely stunned that he could do that, but he sure did. And you know, and then it took them forever and ever and ever to find a Claire, and they went through masses of audition tapes and so forth. And in fact, they finally kind of dug Katrina out of the trash pile. she had done a self tape, you know, on her video on her iPhone, you know, sort of set it with a timer and ran into the photo, and you know, had done it without a casting director or anything like that, but there was just something that caught their attention about her. And so they had, you know, done audition after audition with Sam, you know, looking for chemistry and so forth. And they said there were a ton of really good British actresses, but, you know, they just weren't Claire. And there was something about Katrina that made them think maybe. And so they called her back. And in fact, they flew poor old Sam from Great Britain to Los Angeles, which is an 11-hour flight, to do a one-hour audition with her, and then flew him back 11 hours after. And he said, they took me straight to the shop to have the prostheses for my back and shoulder and hand fitted. Said I was in there for 7 hours. And then at the end of this, they screwed up my cab and left me standing in the middle of a deserted industrial estate, you know, sort of longing for my bed. So, I mean, actors work pretty darn hard. Yeah. Let's see over here. Who's got the mic?
Good evening. My name's Erin, and I'm sure I, along with everyone here, have just worn out my copies of your books. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You spoke a little bit earlier about your fictional writing process, mm-hmm. but I'm currently in the midst of writing a dissertation. Any quick words of advice for a professional writing process?
Yeah, one day at a time. That's the only way to do it. Yeah, no, in fact, the only time I have ever suffered from writer's block in my entire life was while I was writing my dissertation, you know, and I finally got out of it by starting to keep a journal. You know, it wasn't a deep thoughts kind of journal or anything. It was just a straightforward record of what I'd done during the day, because I found that if I had to write, did nothing but read Negro Wolf novels all day, I felt really depressed. But if I could write, you know, analyze the data for figure 2.3, I would feel this nice sense of progress. And I found that I could make myself do something during the day just so I could have the pleasure of recording it at night. So, but from that, I learned that the only way to get over writer's block is you just write anyway. Period, the end. Yeah, I think maybe one more question and then we'll have to stop and go line up. Yeah, that side. Mm-hmm. Oh, him. Yes, okay. Okay. It better be a good question.
My name is Mark.
Hi, Mark.
They may not like my question anymore, but I'm a huge Doctor Who fan.
Oh, great. Me too.
I have been since I was maybe 5 or 6 when I was hiding behind the couch. And is there any chance, have you been talking with Stephen Moffat, with Roger, about maybe having Jamie meet the Doctor again?
That would be pretty cool. But, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I haven't as yet. I would love to talk to Stephen Moffat on, you know, just on general grounds, but I don't know. It's an idea that would probably be much more in Ron's league than mine, though. I have actually nothing to say about how the production goes, but that would be kind of cool. Now, I do know Fraser Hines, who was the original Jamie McCrimmon from that Patrick Troughton episode, and you know, and I've mentioned him to the production people a couple of times because I think it would be very cool for him to have a cameo somewhere. But again, that's up to them. Anyway. Thank you so much. You've been wonderful. You've been wonderful. Thank you. I'll see you there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.